come now to our Tuesday afternoon study period here at 3 o'clock at the Arkansas Camp 1918. Continue now with number 9 in our series on the book of Daniel. And as we closed our last study period, we began to, well, we drew a parallel which will now develop more deeply. And the parallel was between the fact that, first of all, God sent a message to King Nebuchadnezzar, and his acceptance of that message developed a problem, apparently, in the kingdom of Babylon. And his response to that problem was to erect this great image on the plain of Dura, an image, of course, which was entirely of gold from head to foot. So to better understand what the king was about, let's project our view forward for a moment to see the same sequence of events in the closing up of this world's history, in the final great conflict between truth and error. Turn to page 1169 in volume 4 of the Bible Commentary, and here is a comment on the parallel between the image in Nebuchadnezzar's day and the image to be erected down here in these last days. By many, the Sabbath of the fourth commandment is made void, being treated as a thing of naught, while the spurious Sabbath, the child of the papacy, is exalted. In the place of God's laws are elevated the laws of the man of sin, laws that are to be received and regarded as the wonderful golden image of Nebuchadnezzar was by the Babylonians. Forming this great image, Nebuchadnezzar commanded that it should receive universal homage from all, both great and small, high and low, rich and poor. An important part of this paragraph reads, it says, in the place of God's laws. Now, remember this, that a law is a solution to a problem. So we could take out the word laws and place the word solutions in the place. And let's read it now as follows. In the place of God's solutions are elevated the solutions of the man of sin. Solutions or laws that are to be received and regarded as the wonderful golden image of Nebuchadnezzar was by the Babylonians. And that statement, no doubt, has left in our minds about the fact that there is a parallel between the image which was built back there by King Nebuchadnezzar and the image which in turn is to be made in these last days. I turn now to page 976 of volume 7 of the Bible Commentary, where I read these words. History will be repeated. False religion will be exalted. The first day of the week, a common working day possessing no sanctity whatever, will be set up as was the image of Babylon. All nations and tongues and peoples will be commanded to worship the spurious Sabbath. This is Satan's plan to make of no account the day instituted by God and given to the world as a memorial of creation. Now we have two statements, one from an Old Testament comment, the other from the New Testament comment, one from Daniel, one from Revelation, confirming the fact that the image raised up by Nebuchadnezzar is a type of the great image to be raised up in the last days. Now I made the point this morning that there is a very definite sequence of events in regard to this. First of all, we find that there is a message sent by God to King Nebuchadnezzar. And that message created, as we observed this morning, a great problem for the king, in which it no doubt seemed that his kingdom was threatened by insurrection and rebellion throughout the empire. So then, the king made a response to this, and the response, of course, was his solution to the problem, and that was in the erection of the image of the beast. I want now to come down to modern times and from the book Great Controversy trace this identical development down here in the last days. And so we turn to the chapter entitled The Impending Conflict, around about page 593, page 593 or thereabouts. We'll pick up the thought, first of all, on page 582 of the book Great Controversy. Now, of course, you know, Satan is a special device to take the works of God, the providences of God, and to turn them into instruments of destruction. As you saw in the threat to the lives of the wise men of Babylon, Satan tried to use this as a means of destroying Daniel and his three friends as well. And the message which God sent to King Nebuchadnezzar was designed of God to bring great blessing to the king and to his country. But Satan was very quick to turn this, of course, into a threat to the kingdom rather than a blessing to it. Now, coming back to Great Controversy, page 582, I read these words. From the very beginning of the Great Controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's service to overthrow the law of God. It was to accomplish this at the end of the Pontius rebellion against the Creator, and though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. To deceive men and thus lead them to transgress God's law is the object which he has steadfastly pursued. Whether this be accomplished by casting aside the law altogether or by rejecting one of its precepts, the result will be ultimately the same. He that offends in one point manifests contempt for the whole law. His influence and example are on the side of transgression. He becomes guilty of all. In seeking to cast contempt upon the divine statutes, Satan has perverted the doctrines of the Bible, and errors have thus become incorporated into the faith of thousands who profess to believe the Scriptures. The last great conflict between truth and error is but the final struggle of a long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. Upon this battle we are now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah, between the religion of the Bible and the religion of fable and tradition. Now, moving on a little further, we come to page 587, whereupon we are told the results of the presentation and rejection of the third angel's message. We read across the page in 586, the very bottom. Clinging to the papal error of natural immortality and man's consciousness and death, they have rejected the only defense against the delusions of spiritualism. The doctrine of eternal torment has led many to disbelieve the Bible. And as the claims of the fourth commandment are urged upon the people, it is found that the observance of the seventh day Sabbath is enjoined, and is the only way to free themselves from a duty which they are unwilling to perform. Many popular teachers declare the law of God is no longer binding, as they thus cast away the law and the Sabbath together. Now let's go back to the other side of 1844. We'll put down 1844 here now as a point of time. And we go back beyond 1844, to that time before the churches even heard about the first, second, and third angels' messages. And we'll think now of such illustrious names as Wesley, for instance, the last great reformer before we come down to William Miller. And John Wesley, as was Luther and those great reformers, was a very, very earnest teacher of the law of God. They taught that law, making, of course, the mistake of teaching Sunday in the place of Sabbath. But here was the Ten Commandments, and they taught those commandments as being absolutely binding upon Christians. Now, time passed, and we move into the era when the first, then the second, and then the third angel's messages were proclaimed to the people of that day. Now, the message here is a parallel of the message brought to Nebuchadnezzar back at that point of time. Now, that message, of course, as we just read from Great Controversy, very, very definitely proclaimed the law of God and took those reformers further than where they'd been before by showing them that in the Ten Commandments there was the fourth commandment, which so far they had completely overlooked. There it was, and they had completely overlooked the fact that it nominated the seventh day and not the first day of the week. Now, before the claims of the fourth commandment were brought to those people, they heard the first angel's message. And what was the first angel's message? Right, it was the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, when they had rejected the first angel's message, there was no possibility of their receiving the second or the third. Right? Because if you don't put your feet firmly on the first step of the ladder, namely this one, then how can you put your feet upon the second and upon the third? It's not possible. Now, I think you're well aware of the chapter in early writings entitled The Firm Platform, in which Sister White takes us through the history of those rejections and demonstrates how once they had turned down the first angel's message, there was no possibility of their receiving the second and in turn the third. So therefore, when the third angel's message brought to view the glorious Sabbath truth, because they had rejected the first angel's message, there was no possibility of their accepting the Sabbath. And so there was a rejection of the Sabbath truth. Now the Protestant churches, because they claimed to be a Bible-believing people, didn't throw the Bible away, but they threw away the law and the Sabbath together. Now, this creates a problem, a very serious problem. It says, as the work of Sabbath reform extends, this rejection of the divine law to avoid the claims of the fourth commandment will become well nigh universal. The teachings of religious leaders have opened the door to infidelity, to spiritualism, and to contempt for God's holy law. And upon these leaders rests a fearful responsibility for the iniquity that exists in the Christian world. Now let's notice these things then. Infidelity, and what's another word for infidelity? Unfaithfulness to spiritualism. And what is that, of course? Trust in the power of the devil, and to contempt for God's law. Let's notice those three awful things now. The first one again was infidelity. So the outcome then, and this is the problem that's been arising because of this rejection. First of all, infidelity, which in other words is unfaithfulness, spiritualism, and contempt for God's holy law. Now the only possible outcome of that is unbelievable and increasing trouble in the world of this present time. And so now let's make a little list of what this adds up to so far as the world is concerned. First of all, it means that the world becomes filled with iniquity. And that in turn comes in its extreme form to anarchy, of which terrorism is one of the chiefest weapons today. Because terrorism is a form of anarchy where men are their own lawmakers and their own law enforcers. And every man has his own set of laws that just suit himself. Now, it's also manifest in labor troubles, in strikes, and so forth. And what about so far as weather is concerned? It leads to all kinds of natural disasters, such as hurricanes, earthquakes, droughts, floods, great conflagrations, and so forth. And so we find there's a mounting trouble that develops in the world. Let's move on now a little further. Of course, to compound the problem, I'll read more on page 587. To compound the problem, the very class who caused all this trouble by rejection of God's law and have brought in this infidelity, spiritualism, contempt for God's law, initially, to meet this problem, increased their activities of rejection of God's law, and thus bring about more trouble still, arguing to the people that the failure to respect the Sunday Sabbath is the problem. So I read, yet this very class, is still page 587, yet this very class put forth the claim that the fast-spreading corruption is largely attributable to the desecration of the so-called Sunday Christian Sabbath, and that the enforcement of Sunday observance would greatly improve the morals of society. This action, of course, is a further rejection of God's Sabbath and God's law, which response to the problem will only serve to further compound the difficulties already developing. Now, going a little further over now to page 588, we have these familiar statements about spiritualism being the great bonding factor between Protestants and Catholics and atheists. As the three unclean spirits like frogs go forth to the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the great battle of God Almighty. Now, on the next page 589, we're told of the further development of these problems as spiritualism becomes more and more active and more and more powerful among the churches and people of this present generation. So I read, through spiritualism, Satan appears as a benefactor of the race, healing the diseases of the people, and professing to present a new and more exalted system of religious faith. But at the same time, he works as a destroyer. His temptations are leading multitudes to ruin. Intemperance dethrones reason. Sensual indulgence, strife, and bloodshed follow. Satan delights in war, for it excites the worst passions of the soul and then sweeps into eternity its victims steeped in vice and blood. It is his object to incite the nations to war against one another, for he can thus divert the minds of the people from the work of preparation to stand in the day of the Lord, the day of God. So, through spiritualism, Satan excites war in the world. Moving on now to natural disasters, we read, Satan works through the elements also to garner his harvest of unprepared souls. He has studied the secrets of the laboratories of nature, and he uses all his power to control the elements as far as God allows. When he was suffered to afflict Job, how quickly flocks and herds, servants, houses, children were swept away, one trouble such hitting another as in a moment. It is God that shields his creatures and hedges them in from the power of the destroyer. But the Christian world has shown contempt for the law of Jehovah, and the Lord will do just what he has declared that he would. He will withdraw his blessings from the earth and remove his protecting care from those who are rebelling against his law and teaching and forcing others to do the same. Satan has control of all whom God does not especially guard. He will favor and prosper some in order to further his own designs, and he will bring trouble upon others and lead men to believe that it is God who is afflicting them. While appearing to the children of men as a great physician who can heal all their diseases, he will bring disease and disaster until populous cities are reduced to ruin and desolation. Even now he is at work in accidents and calamities by sea and by land, in great conflagrations, in fierce tornadoes and terrific hailstorms, in tempests, floods, cyclones, tidal waves, and earthquakes. In every place, in a thousand forms, Satan is exercising his power. He sweeps away the ripening harvest, and famine and distress follow. He imparts to the air a deadly taint, and thousands perish by the pestilence. These visitations are to become more and more frequent and disastrous. Destruction will be upon both man and beast. The earth mourneth and fadeth away, the haughty people do languish. The earth also is defiled with inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Now these things largely are no more a prophecy. They are the facts of present-day history, isn't that so? Terrific hailstorm. Did you hear about the terrible hailstorm which went through the Dakotas this year and absolutely pulverized the main cash crop, the cabbages? And of course you know from personal experience of the drought which has laid its heavy hand upon this state, Texas and Oklahoma. Remember the fearful hurricanes which have battered various parts of the country over the past 2 years? Last year it was Mobile, Alabama. This year it was Corpus Christi in Texas. And, of course, at the present time, we're well aware of the fact that continuous wars are going on in some parts of the world, such as Ireland and the Middle East. Crime is on the increase, and man is coming to realize that his very existence is being threatened by the increasing trouble which is coming upon the world. Just the same as back then Nebuchadnezzar felt his kingdom was threatened by the spirit of rebellion and revolt, which was aided and abetted by the interpretation given to the dream by Daniel and accepted by the king. Now, the response of modern man to this trouble will be as follows. The time will come when these troubles will become so developed, they will so threaten man's entire existence around the entire world, that all men will agree something has to be done, and the cry will go out, do something, do something. And men will do something, and they're preparing for it at the present time. The other day, as I was travelling across the country, I was listening to Paul Harding Hughes, and he made the observation that there was a time when the Protestant churches traditionally kept themselves clean of politics. But no more, he said. The time has come when it has now become the policy of major Protestant organizations to take up politics and to exert a powerful influence at the poll. Now, very obviously, of course, the people tend to follow their preachers. They regard them as being their spiritual directors. And when the ministry take up a certain line of thought, which of course will always be in the church's interest, the people are going to vote in that direction, thus giving into the power of the church the power of the state in the very near future. And that is happening right at the present time, an increasing infiltration of churches into politics. And of course we realize that the Roman Catholic Church, in her own quiet way, but very powerful and effective way, has been manipulating politics for a long, long time. She is the master church, of course, that church-state relationship. Now read a little further on page 519. And then the great deceiver will persuade men that those who serve God are causing these evils. The class that have provoked the displeasure of heaven will charge all their troubles upon those whose obedience to God's commandments is a perpetual reproof to transgressors. It will be declared that men are offending God by the violation of the Sunday Sabbath, that this sin has brought calamities which will not cease until Sunday observance shall be strictly enforced. Now, by the time we come to the statement, of course, we have passed beyond the actual making of the image, because it talks about strict enforcement of the existing Sunday laws, and that temple prosperity will not be experienced. There will be no return to temple prosperity until they strictly enforce these laws. And we're told, of course, in other parts of the spirit of prophecy, that national apostasy, which is the making of the Sunday law, is what will bring national disaster or national ruin. That's the word, national ruin. So therefore, surely as this paragraph talks about the loss of that national prosperity, the Sunday laws have already by this time been passed. But now, initially, as the people of the world become aware, the church has become aware of the fact that they can no longer handle all these troubles which are developing in the world, they would go forth to cry for a common leader, one great central figure to be the problem solver for mankind. They will have lost faith in the American president, and understandably so, because president after president has shown himself quite unable to handle these tremendous problems. But there's a great and glowing figure emerging on the horizon, showing greater and greater prominence and power and effectiveness in dealing with situations, and that is, of course, the Pope of Rome. And the whole world will start to wonder after the beast, and as Nebuchadnezzar of old enforced a universal image law, so in these last days again, the response of mankind will be to set up the image of the beast, and by law will call upon all men to bow and worship on the so-called sacred Sunday. And very shortly after, of course, there will come the buy-sell decree to put extra pressure upon those people. And last of all, there will come the death decree when those who refuse to bow be threatened with extinction as they were back in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, what I want you to see very plainly is that what took place back there in the days of Nebuchadnezzar was certainly a preview or a type or a forepicture of what will take place and is taking place down here in these last days. Here is a succession of events, the rejection of the law and the Sabbath together, which brings in infidelity, spiritualism, contempt for the law, which brings iniquity, anarchy, terrorism, strikes, natural disasters, until man feels his very existence is threatened by these terrible things. And then in response to that, they will bring in a human solution, which is the worst thing that they could do, because it only increases the cause of all this trouble, and only those who and all those who do not doubt are threatened with a boycott, and then their lives are endangered by the death decree, just as it was back in the days of Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego. So past history will be repeated. That's clear, isn't it? Very, very clear and plain. Let's go back to the Daniel, the third chapter, and look more closely at the history of what took place back in his day, because the better we understand the first picture, of course, the better we shall follow the second picture through, as I've just outlined it there from the book Great Controversy. Now then, chapter 3 and verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 80 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Okay. Now Nebuchadnezzar is making a statement here, a statement to be read by every person throughout the kingdom. A statement that was made so loud and so clear, so plainly, that not one being upon the face of the earth could mistake the message proclaimed by Nebuchadnezzar by doing this thing. Now, the confession made by him, as to the correctness of Daniel's interpretation, had been given to a very limited audience, just a few people, comparatively speaking, of course, there in his own private throne room or courtroom. And so, many folks throughout the realm probably had to believe what was said there on the basis of other people's reports. And you can be quite certain, of course, that by the time the message of what took place in that courtroom that day had travelled through 1,000 different voices a couple of 1,000 miles across the country, it would have got to be rather embellished, don't you think? And would bear little resemblance to the true account given back there in the courtroom. So Nebuchadnezzar desired to set the record straight. Straight as he wanted it to be set straight, not as he confessed it back there in the courtroom. And so he was saying in effect to the people, now look, you heard that there was a vision of an image, head of gold, breast and arms of silver, belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, feet of iron and clay, which was pulverized by a great stone and came to absolutely nothing. Now I'll show you the real truth of the matter, namely that the image is all of gold. And there is no stone to crush it to fragments and pulverize it. And this great image represents the kingdom of Babylon, which was symbolized by gold in the original vision. Gold being, of course, above all else, the metal that typified the wealth and riches of that old empire ruled over by that great king. Now, not only was Nebuchadnezzar speaking to his people, but he was also speaking back to God. He was saying to God, very well, I did, perhaps there for a short time, become so impressed by the message sent to me in the image that I did recognize you as being right and true and correct, that your ways were the only ways of life. But I repent of that, conviction now, and instead I come back again to do battle with you over this particular thing. And I am saying, by making this golden image, that I reject the impressions that were given to me by Daniel in that courtroom. And instead I revert back to my original position that Babylon's ways are the only ways of final and absolute success. Man doesn't need God. Man is self-sufficient. Man is the master of his own fate. Man will build a kingdom that will never ever pass away. So spoke Nebuchadnezzar back to God when he built this image. In other words, once again, Nebuchadnezzar had entered the battlefield and the struggle was against the true church of God. And once again, Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego were the soldiers in God's army to stand up and fight for his great cause. Now verse 2. Well, first of all, we'll read a little more about from verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 80 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now what strikes your attention immediately about the dimensions of this image? It was 80 cubits, which is 60 cubits high, and the breadth thereof was 6 cubits. Now what's the obviously dominant number that appears in those dimensions, common to both? 6. And of what is 6 the symbol? of man, right, is the symbol of man living and carrying out things by his own way. Man is his own plan maker and problem solver and burden bearer. I've been quite amazed, you know, to notice that when men build great monuments for themselves, I haven't checked every one of man's great monuments, but I was very interested to see the arch, that very proud arch built out at St. Louis, where you say it in this country, in Missouri. It's called the Gateway of the West, and practically every dimension in that arch, I noticed, was a multiple of six. The distance from across the base, the height of it, and the actual size of the triangles. It was a triangle, of course, but the base of the two triangles, which made six sides altogether, with this side and this side. And that number six appeared over and over again on that very, very proud piece of human workmanship. And I don't doubt that others of man's great monoliths and obelisks and whatever else are multiples of six. Now, verse 2 brings to view a very interesting technique often employed by the Babylonian kings. It says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up." Now, the king did not call for the millions of people who made up the entire kingdom. He called instead for the ruling men, judges, sheriffs, princes, and so forth, and called upon them to come to the dedication of this great image. The idea was, of course, that they should be so awed, so impressed, so won over by this fantastic spectacle. Now, you imagine it. How many of you folk have seen pure gold? It's an unbelievably beautiful metal, isn't it? Really, it's a beautiful metal. And imagine a great image, 60 cubits high, which is about 90 feet in height. So I understand a cubit is about 18 inches, wasn't it? There are various cubits, of course, but in any case, it was quite a height. Now, I think about 90 feet high and 18 feet wide at the shoulders. And this huge amount of gold, can you begin to imagine the value of that gold at today's price of $650 per ounce? Imagine the value of it. It must have been worth billions upon billions of modern dollars. And as the sun came up and shone upon that surface, and the rich golden color came glowing back to the people, it seemed sometimes as if an image was literally on fire before their eyes. What a dazzling spectacle of riches and power. What could not King Nebuchadnezzar have bought with that amount of gold even back in those days? And the idea was that these rulers should be so impressed by this fantastic spectacle that they would carry back with them the awe and the wonder and convey this to their people, who would share in their recognition of Nebuchadnezzar's supremacy and would forget all about the stories that had been told about the king acknowledging the passing away of Babylon. And thus the king hoped very effectively through this system, this pyramid system of communication, to settle the kingdom and maintain it in a condition of stability and peace and tranquility. Today the same system is used. I've seen an operation as follows. In the Seventh Adventist Church there are a small number of men, about half a dozen or so, who apparently are employed to spend their time in research and study. And then from time to time they go out to the four corners of the earth. They come down to Australia. Every minister, not the people, just the ministry and the workers, are called in to some central location such as Avondale College, where there's ample accommodation, the students all being away on vacation, ample classrooms, and therefore 6 weeks there is an extremely intensive program of teaching, 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 teaching. And it's so concentrated that the young men, or the ministers in general, not all young men of course, they sit there and they furiously write down notes. They don't have time to think or to ask questions. It's what they call a crash course. And the excuse is made, of course, that the preachers can't go back to school all the year, and the visitors from overseas have other work to do, so they must get back to their jobs too. So they telescope a year's work, or maybe a couple of years' work, into 6 short weeks. Well, the ministers seem to go home drunken with this concentration of information, and they're just bursting to pour it out to their people, and they do. And so as they, with unquestioning confidence in what they've been taught, pour this out to the people believe it and accept it, and so just a few men at the top of the organization are able to control the thinking of practically every member in the movement. It's exactly the same technique that was used by Nebuchadnezzar back there on the plains of Jura, and it works remarkably well. Now, the reason for Daniel's not being at this dedication, we know he wasn't, because most certainly if he had been there, he would never have bowed to the image. And so the fact he was not reported as not bowing is proof he wasn't there. And the simple reason is that when the king sought to make him a governor, as you read in the last verse of the previous chapter, he declined and gave the role instead to Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego. The king accepted that, and those men became rulers in the province of Babylon. So they were amongst those who were summoned by the king, and therefore had to appear before the image with the rest of the people. Let's read on now to verse 3. Which simply tells us that all the princes, governors, captains, etc., gathered together at the king's command before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 4. Then a herald cried aloud to you that commanded their people, nations and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of a cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoso falls not down and worship it shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Right, now, this of course brings to view the old tactics of Babylon, the use of force. Nebuchadnezzar was determined that there was going to be no argument about who was king in the world at that point of time. If you bowed down, then you remained a part of the kingdom. If you didn't bow down, you were killed. And of course, to be thrown into a burning fiery furnace wasn't a very pleasant prospect, because no one seems to like being fried alive in a burning fire of that intensity. Now, some of those, it appears to me, and of course I can't be sure of this, but it does appear that some of those Chaldeans whose lives have been saved by Daniel previously still resented the superiority of Daniel and his three friends, and they saw now the opportunity to get even. To get even with being saved, of course, by killing those who saved them. Verse 8, wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews, and they spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee, they serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. I appreciate the fact that those men recognize the significance of the action of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. They recognize that those young men did not just merely refuse to bow to the image, but they did not acknowledge and they did not worship the gods of Babylon, the ones that Nebuchadnezzar himself served. And this, of course, was the real issue in the matter, because those gods symbolized the principle of man in the place of God. Those gods were symbolic of Nebuchadnezzar's way of doing things, and that is what Meshach and his two friends rejected on this particular occasion. And so those Chaldeans came and told the king about these men who had refused to bow down. Now here's something very interesting. We're told in the old Spalding McGann collection of spirit prophecy statements that those who will betray us to the Babylonians or the Roman Catholics in the end will not be the Catholics themselves, because to them will be quite unknown. And obviously Nebuchadnezzar was not able to visibly observe the refusal of these men to bow down, and he depended upon other men bringing to him the report of their refusal. So likewise, we should be so little known to the Catholics in the last days that they'll not even be aware of our refusal to bow down and worship upon the Sunday. But who will betray us? The Protestants. And who are the most Protestant of all Protestants today? the Seventh-day Adventists. And you'll be certain that they know us, they know about us, and they know us, and they are the ones who, like those magicians back there, will betray us. Now, I mention this because the magicians, of course, were in the same class as Daniel. Daniel is regarded as the chief of the magicians. And therefore, it was those who were nearest to Daniel and his three friends who were the ones who brought the betrayal at that point of time. And the last days, of course, once more, history is going to be repeated, because those who are nearest to us, who know us the best, those who are once our fellow believers right in this movement, they're the ones who will be our worst opposers when that great and terrible day shall come. So when it does come, don't be surprised. There's nothing new about it. The worthies back there in the Old Testament went through the same ordeal, and how can we expect to find anything less in the closing up of this world's history? Time has come to close, so we'll stop at this point and pick up our theme again. It's now 4:10. Let's make it back at 4:15.